Breakfast puppies?
This podcast contains adult language and content and is meant for mature audiences. Listener discretion is advised.
We're all set to begin, so let's dive right in to Bikers, Dice, and Bars. Talking bicycles and motorbikes, gamer things and all the like. You can listen to it in your cars. But mostly it's about dive bars. Bikers, Dice, and Bars.
Hey, Jacob, what are we drinking?
Tonight we're drinking a take on the classic non-alcoholic cocktail, Lemon Ginger Fizz.
Ooh.
We've modified a stock Lemon Ginger Fizz recipe with a slight dash of pomegranate. And the an expressed Cara orange peel.
Oh, wow.
Ooh.
Well, this is a change of pace.
This is tasty. Hey, we have a special guest tonight.
Yeah, we do.
Joe, what do you think of this drink?
I think it tastes pretty good. It's not too bitter, like I would think, you know, with some citrus in there, but it's actually got some good flavor to it.
It's got a nice complex flavor to it, and the fizziness isn't like super overwhelming.
Yes.
So I see you use reeds for this.
Yes, intentionally.
And you also have Cock and Bull in front of you.
Yes.
That is unopened.
Correct.
The reason for using reeds instead of Cock and Bull?
So in this particular build, I went with reeds because even though it's reeds extra, reeds is not as sharp. And when you're pairing it with the lemon juice in many ginger ales will enhance the bite of the ginger. And so to make it a little bit more palatable, to be able to bring out the pomegranate notes and to be able to catch the hint of the Cara orange, I went with reeds, which is not as aggressive as Cock and Bull.
Speaking of things that are not as aggressive as Cock and Balls, you're listening to Bikers, Dice, and Bars, recorded here in Portland, Oregon. As usual, I'm NBC.
I'm just Jacob.
The Dr. Xander Gerrymander.
I am Poppy Beaujolais. And we have a special guest with us this evening.
My name is Joe.
Hi, Joe.
Hey.
Do you work in a button factory?
No, I do not.
What is it you do, Joe?
Well, I have a leather goods business here in Portland. I run my business from home, but I have my stuff in multiple stores in Portland. I also sell online and have multiple Instagram accounts, which I also sell on there as well.
Ooh, and we will get to that. We'll definitely get all those links later.
Yeah.
Joe, the reason why I've asked you here today is two reasons. Reason number one is a couple of years, 2 years ago, you rode your bicycle from, I believe, Portland to San Francisco.
It was, yeah, roughly that. I did Portland to, let's see, it was a about 20 miles past Santa Cruz.
Mm-hmm.
So a little bit further down. But yeah, I actually did hang out in the San Francisco area for probably a couple weeks.
What kind of bike are we talking here? Motorized?
Got a touring bike. It is a Soma Saga Disc. I built that up myself a few years back. And I built it specifically for touring, which I got into years ago. And I love it. So, you know, being able to do that a couple of years back and ride all the way down the coast, it was fun because the longest I've done before that was about 2 weeks. And since then, I've wanted to do a longer trip. And that was about 2 months down the coast. So
that was actually my next question is how long did it take you? But on average, so were you trying to go for a specific amount of miles a day or was it more of this part of the coast is not as pretty, so I'm just going to keep going? Or what kind of determined your pace?
Well, what was nice about this is I was not on any time limit. So I just spent a couple months out there and I was going to come back to Portland. However, I didn't have a specific date to come back. So that was what was really nice and different about this one. Every time before I've had a specific time I had to be back.
And what I think made your trip extra interesting, it wasn't just you're like, oh, I'm going to ride down the I-5 corridor on my bicycle just for fun. You actually ran your leather business off the back of your bicycle as well, which I think is fascinating. And I'd love to hear more about, running a home, a quote unquote home-based business when you are not when the world is your home, as it were.
Running a business on a bicycle while traveling, my first question actually is, What route did you take?
So I actually went out to the 101 and I started heading down 101. And I got out to, where was that? Arcata, where I have a friend that lives out there. And, you know, I stayed there for about a week. And then after that, I actually got a ride with him down to Sacramento. So there was a part there where I did skip some of the coast. From there, I went back out to San Francisco and rode down. But I rode back up the coast after that to Sacramento. Well, San Francisco, then back out to Sacramento. So I kind of did, you know, backtracked a bit. I was also going back and forth from Santa Cruz, about 20 miles past 30 different campgrounds, and just kind of back and forth. So
my curiosity too, when you're running a business off the back of a bicycle to a place where you might not be known, how do you let people know that you're there to sell them leather goods?
Oh, so basically I wasn't going with the intent of trying to find places to sell leather goods, but I was actually making things and posting them on my Instagram and then also posting them in my Etsy shop. So my plan actually was to just kind of, you know, take the time to create different things and then also just post stuff online. However, I did have a sign made before I left with my business logo on that I had put on my bike. So, and I put my Instagram on there thinking people would follow me on my Instagram. And actually what had happened was people would actually pull up all in their cars and ask me to pull over. And they wanted to talk to me about my sign on my bike. And, you know, so that was completely unexpected. And I actually sold quite a few things doing that. And especially at co-ops, I think I did the best when I would stop there to get some food. And I just have my bike sitting there with my sign on it. People would come up and, you know, they'd ask me about what I was doing. And I mean, obviously I was on an adventure. I had a fully loaded touring bike, but also they wanted to know about the sign on my bike. So I had wallets and stuff that I had made. And so I had one bag with several wallets in it. And, you know, I would just open that and show people and they thought it was cool. And I was selling them at a discounted price of, you know, what I would sell them up here for. So I actually sold quite a few. I was not expecting that. I was expecting maybe some business online. So
I'm passing around a picture from your Instagram account of your full bike and trailer and rig. The sign is not in that one, but I just want the guys here to get an idea of what you were traveling with. That's the one I'm
that was when I was testing out different ideas here before I had left to do this idea. That was just kind of cruising around here in the Pacific Northwest. This was actually out to the coast and back, and I had a lot more weight on this than I did whenever I went on my trip. But I just want to try out different things and see if I could actually do it. And after pulling that out to the coast and back, I figured I could.
So another question I have too is, how did you fall into the leather goods making industry? It's not exactly a common thing, I would say.
He was hiding from the law.
I knew it.
Well, there's a little bit of a story to that. Let's see, over, I want to say 12, 13 years ago, I was actually traveling around the country on freight trains. And I remember, I was getting off a train in Indiana. I heard something fall and, you know, I didn't really look around, but I ended up walking to the store. It was about a mile away and I reached for my wallet and it was gone. And I realized what had fallen was my wallet. So I go back to this train and, you know, there's a guy sitting in the yard. He was working and I told him my wallet was on the train. And he told me if I go in the yard, he'd call the police. So I waited and then the train started moving. It had my wallet, all my money, everything in it. So, you know, I was kind of bummed. But, you know, shortly after that, I made my way back here to Portland and then went down to California. I came back up here. My brother had given me a place to stay. So I got off the street and, you know, I wasn't expecting to do that. But, you know, at the time, I was having issues with drinking and I had no hobbies. I also wanted to get a job. So I started looking for jobs and trying to think of, you know, something to keep myself busy so I could, you know, not drink. So my idea at the time was to, you know, make myself a wallet because I needed one. You know, I went to a local company here and bought a scrap of leather. And, you know, I had no idea what I was doing, but I had a pattern I got from a friend down in California for a wallet that was similar to the one I lost. So I ended up just cutting out this leather, sewing it together. It looked awful, but you know, it worked. And I actually used this for years, but that was what got me into just doing it as a hobby. You know, years went by where I was just making little random things here and there whenever I had time. But it wasn't until I started making some fetish gear and, you know, some people had seen that and they thought it was pretty cool. And they're like, hey, you should, you know, start a business. And I heard that from a few people. So I started shopping stuff around. you know, and I got into a local company here, which was pretty cool. And I've also got an Etsy account for that as well. But that was kind of what started the whole thing of me getting into the business. It was a hobby for a while, which, you know, I wasn't really that active in, but.
So since then, have you ever done the train hopping again?
No. I mean, actually, whenever I got off the street here, for the next 2 years after that, there were a few times where I rode trains down to California or just down to Eugene, you know, just for the hell of it. It was fun. But since then, I have not done it. It's a completely different lifestyle, and it's not a lifestyle I want to get back into.
Fair enough.
What is the physical, what is the act of getting on the train? Do you like run up? Do you run up and jump on it? Do you wait till no one's looking and sneak in? Is the movies always make it look like someone's, you know, running up and they leap on and they have their feet hanging off the boxcar kind of thing. Is it anything like that, or is it like totally different?
I have done that. I have grabbed onto moving trains. at the times I've done that, I was actually pretty intoxicated. I've fallen off of three that I know of. The last time I actually fell off one, I don't remember. I was with my brother in a boxcar going from Portland to Eugene. I woke up under a bridge down there, and he told me that I was stumbling around the boxcar while it was moving, and I just went out, and he jumped off when it stopped. And, you know, I don't remember that, but the other times I have actually grabbed onto moving trains, and I was dragged for about a mile once before I let go because I thought I could pull myself up. But so that was very dangerous to do. But typically, if you go to a train yard, they have, you know, they might have a whole bunch of tracks in there, but they have two main tracks. Any major yard does. There's going to be signal lights at the end of the yard. So if you can find a spot to wait by those signal lights, the train will stop. And if you have a general idea of where what train goes to, you know, what train yard, then, you know, you can kind of figure it out. I mean, I've gotten on trains before and ended up in different parts of the country. And just, you know, and that was more like when I was waiting for a train, I'm like, I know where this train will go, but, you know, start drinking and get impatient and see a train and just jump on it, knowing that it's not going the right direction, then wake up in some other place. So
we here at Bikers, Dice, and Bars do not recommend the trespassing onto train yards and riding trains. Where
so I've noticed a lot of trains lately have gone away from the boxcar kind of setup and more of just like these other things that look like there's no possible place for you to actually sit in them. Is that a thing that I am just making up in my head, or is that a actual thing that trains are now doing now to discourage rapscallions such as yourself from doing things like this?
You know, I'm not too sure. I haven't really paid much attention to that, but I do know the cars that don't look like they have anywhere where you can get on do have spots where you can hide. I know there's some like Grainers, for example, or Canadian Grainers have a little hole on the end. You can climb in and you've got a very small space where you can get in the fetal position and, you know, just hang out inside there. So there are spaces where you can climb in. No one can see you in there. That's just one example. And there's also the ones with the big containers. Some don't have any floor, which I've ridden on those. I was once on one with no floor for 2 days. That was pretty scary. But some of them, they won't have floors, but other ones will. So, you know, if it's sunny outside and you're looking at the ground and you see one going by, if you see sun go through on the ground, that means there's no floor. So there's ways to kind of figure those things out. But there's pretty much always something to get on. I have gotten on cars where you shouldn't have gone on. I got pulled off one that was for lumber in somewhere in California right after I turned 18. I was with my brother and his girlfriend. And we, you know, broad daylight going through Amtrak, and the cops saw us and stopped the train and pulled us off. So
like you do.
Yes. So there's some you don't get on, but yeah.
So when the cops go and they go and drag you off a train, is it usually just a, hey, don't do this again? Or do they just kind of go and book it because they're feeling not, because they're bored? Or how does that usually work?
It depends on where you're at. And so I've heard if they stop the train for a while, it ends up costing the company quite a bit of money because it kind of messes up the whole schedule. Mm. So, you know, I'm not sure about that. I've heard that it could be a felony. I know people who've been to jail
yes,
for 30 to 60 days at a time. And if you do get stopped in a place where, you know, there's no police or no one watching, sometimes people will get beat up by the police. So,
okay. I want to bring this back to the bicycle, and you're traveling your route. You went 101 for the most part then. How terrifying is that on a bicycle with the crazy ass traffic on 101?
Well, I think with 101, the thing is, with the lanes there, a lot of places they are wider. But they are pretty scary when you go to places where there's a lot of fog. You know, I actually had a car pull up to me while I was going through the fog because I could not see anything, and they turned their hazard lights on and drove right next to me until the fog cleared up, which was really nice of them to do. But I think a lot of it is you've got to be aware of what's around you. You know, a few years ago, I got a mirror for my bike. I had never used one of those before. And that helps so much because with all that weight on the bike riding, you, if you turn around and then look back in front of you and there's any wind, it kind of throws you off and you can swerve around. So that is something that has helped significantly. I'm constantly looking in my mirror. I always have lights on the front and the back of my bike. I've got bright things on my bike. So I think that's key, is just, you know, paying attention to what's around you.
So if someone wanted to go and look into going and taking really long distance bike rides, you were mentioning you did a couple practice trips to the coast. Is that kind of the best way to do it and kind of see what configuration works, or just kind of a general way to have someone start this?
Oh, so, you know, there is a company where I get my maps from. They are a nonprofit based out of Missoula, and they create all these maps for different routes in the U.S. So I started off by getting routes or maps from them and just kind of looking at different places. And I would create a short trip, you know, maybe 100 miles or so.
And I think I remember from conversations we had a few years ago that there's actually an online community for long haul bike writers, where you can kind of stop at a friendly house and what's it called? Like Warm Showers?
Warm Showers.
Warm,
yes.
Shower. What,
warm
is showers. That, what is that? Yeah.
So that started in 96. Basically, I think it might be similar to the couch surfing app. I've never actually used that, but I've heard about it. So Warm Showers, you can find someone that will host you if you're on a bike tour. And usually, well, pretty much always, that host is going to be someone who does bike tours themselves. So they kind of have an idea of where you're coming from when you get there.
Similarly, about the same time Warm Showers started up, which got used by a lot of friends and colleagues of mine over the years, there are two different adventure rider for motorcyclists websites started up that were the exact same idea. So that community supporting community aspect of it, of when you pull in, the person, you know, the people there, and it's a little less of a sketch situation, mm-hmm. has deep roots in all two wheeled communities.
Oh, it's interesting.
So when you're on one of these rides, aside from your goods that you're selling, and I'm guessing a toolkit to continue making some goods in case you run out.
Yes.
What's in your bag?
So I always have at least one big pannier full of food, at least a few days worth of food. For some reason, I'm always on top of that.
Real quick, yeah. What kind of food?
Lots of snack stuff, lots of dark chocolate. I always have extra, usually little espresso drinks. I drink lots of coffee. I also drink lots of coffee while I'm riding my bike. But I always, sometimes I'll have, you know, up to 10 dark chocolate bars just in case I run out. that various snacks and things I can put hot water in.
Okay.
Important question. Tuna, yes, no.
Yes.
Canned or pouched?
Pouched.
Excellent. You and I can be friends.
Other question. What kind of dark chocolate bars we have in here?
Oh, let's see.
Hey, I'm asking the hard-hitting questions here, NPC. It's called journalism. Look it up sometime.
Have you heard of William Randolph Hearst?
Yellow.
Okay, sorry. And continue.
So, the ones I find most commonly are Altered Ego, Theo, let's see, Chalk Love. Those ones I usually come across. If I come across any stores that sell something that looks really good, because I love dark chocolate, I will purchase that. So that's one fun thing about, you know, traveling, is I find other places with different kinds of dark chocolate. That and coffee. Anytime I found a different roasters that looked like they had some good coffee, I would try that out.
Now the whole stopping at co-ops makes sense.
Yes.
Also, good choice on Theo. That's great. Mm-hmm. Chalk Love is usually pretty good. Have you heard, and may I go and preach to you, have you heard of the good people of Woodblock?
Yes. That chocolate's delicious as well.
You know who runs the chocolate factory?
I do not.
Charlie. That is not a joke.
Really? Wow. Charlie has a chocolate factory.
He does, and it's
amazing.
Great.
Amazing.
Okay, after the food and the chocolate, what's next?
I've got one bag full of usually clothes. I'll have a rain gear. For some reason, I never use the rain gear, but it just makes me feel comfortable having it. I'll ride in the rain all day and get soaked and not use it still. But I've also usually got about four pairs of shoes, at least. I have a whole bag, yeah, full of all my leather tools. I've got leather scraps and then other little pieces of leather. With the leather, I actually had companies sending me leather through general delivery while I was out traveling, so I wouldn't have to carry all this leather with me. So it kind of lightened the load a little bit, but I still have stuff on me so I can make things while I'm traveling. Oh, and then let's see. I've got my handlebar bag, and that's what I keep all kinds of snacks and, you know, stuff in. And then I've got also a lithium ion battery. I've got speakers, iPod, stove. I've got one whole bag dedicated to just kitchen stuff, and also a portable espresso maker that I keep with me.
So you're dedicated,
yes,
to that
and pour over and coffee press. Yes, I make sure I've got all that set up.
What brand portable espresso maker?
Nanopresso.
Nanopresso. Good choice. Yes, that works well. That's what I have in my rig for long haul motorcycling.
I use it daily still. It's great.
Okay, quick aside, general delivery mail. Now, how does that work if you don't have a permanent address?
That you don't actually need one, and I didn't know about that until I started that trip. I had stuff shipped to me. If you go to a post office, as far as I can remember, if you get that zip code, I don't know if it was the zip code or there was another post or another number, you can actually use that and have a package sent to the post office. You go in, I think, with your ID, and you can pick it up.
Without, you don't need like a box number, or like you said, just general delivery, and they keep it behind the counter?
Yes, which was kind of odd to me when I went to go pick it up. I'm like, that's all you need? So
fascinating. So it's just like
outstanding.
It's just like, you know, your name, general delivery.
I believe, I don't remember exactly how that worked, but it was something like that. Oh, yes.
Fascinating. Okay, yeah. Well, that's good to know.
Yeah. Huh.
So where do you sleep usually?
So for the most part, I stayed in campgrounds, which is pretty nice, especially along the coast. Oregon is really good for this as well. I did find that California also had some good spots, but they do what's called hiker biker. California is called hike and bike, I believe. So I think different states have different names for it. But basically, if you're hiking through or you come through on a bike, you pay... California, most of the time I paid $5. Oregon used to be $5. I think it went up to $7 for most places, sometimes $8. But you have your own little section that's meant for people on bikes or hiking through. Most of the time I only see people on bikes, which is nice. So it's very cheap. And yeah.
So if I had a really nice bike full of, I don't know, all of my worldly possessions, how do you secure that? Or is it just not an issue at these campgrounds?
It is an issue. I think everyone should always be cautious with that because there are people that go to campgrounds, especially on the coast, and they look for people with touring bikes. And it doesn't happen often, but it does happen. And I've heard those stories before. So if I find someone else that's bike touring there, they're usually trustworthy people. You can kind of get a feel when you get there. So if there's other people that are at that campground, I like to go talk to them, then set my stuff up, then go take a shower, you know, do whatever else I need to do. But other than that, I try keeping all my stuff with me. I used to, if I would go to a campground by myself and there was no one there, I would just take my bike into the shower with me if I took a shower. Otherwise, if I go into a store, I lock up my wheels, I lock up something, and I make sure I can keep an eye on my bike the entire time. So if the only way someone's going to steal that is if they pull up with a truck and a couple people throw it in, or they might be able to grab something off it. So I take anything that looks like it's worth money, like my speakers, stuff like that, and I put them away.
A fair number of my acquaintances who do bike touring, one of the few reasons they travel in groups is specifically for security.
Yeah, that's good.
I mean, they're not worried about getting injured. Many of them would prefer to be on their own, but every last one of them has at some point or another had something stolen off their bike, or in one case had their entire rig go missing.
And then you're pretty well screwed.
Yes. Yeah. And those, I mean, when people do build up their bikes or take, you know, get all the gear together, it ends up coming out to be quite a bit of money sometimes. So I know mine is. So that would be devastating.
Now, you said you did this for 2 months, was it?
I did the coast for 2 months. For 3 months prior to that, I was just kind of around the Pacific Northwest, basically between Portland and the coast for 3 months before doing that. So I was on my bike for a total of 5 months.
Just living on the bike?
Yes.
Fantastic.
Oh, it was fun.
Wow. Now, how long ago was this?
This actually started, I want to say June, or I think it was either June or July 15th, 2018.
Gotcha.
And that went until November. Yeah, it was 2018. Went until November 15th.
Would you do it again?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. I already have thoughts of, every time I'm on a bike tour, I got into this 2012. So every time I'm doing a bike tour, I'm thinking about my next tour, where I want to go. I've got all these ideas of different places, you know, and every time I do one, I have some kind of, you know, idea of where I'm going. I have everything mapped out. And I always end up doing some different route. So there's always something always changes no matter what. That's just how it happens.
Now, one thing I did not hear you mention in your list of goods that you were taking on your touring bike was any kind of maintenance stuff for your bike. What were you carrying as far as that is concerned?
I actually do have, I didn't think about that. I do have a small ratchet set, and basically every bit will fit every part on my bike. So I have that. I've got spare tubes, a patch kit. I've got a bike pump. I have a spare bike pump because once I got a flat in the middle of nowhere, my pump broke. I got to a town. And they were, all the bike shops were closed that day. The following day was a holiday. So I decided to chance a 93-mile bike ride with no services. And I was able to get just enough air in my tire, just the bare minimum to do that. And I probably shouldn't have done that, but I did it. I made it to the next town. I got a bike pump the next day. And then when I got back to Portland, I got another bike pump that's smaller. So I always have two of those now.
Good call.
Yeah. And then I actually just found out about a part that I just bought. It's, about a bit as big as a 50-cent piece. So you can put it onto your hub and it will take the cassette off. Before you'd have to have a whole tool for that. And I just found out about this. So I'm paranoid about breaking a spoke. I don't want to bring all the other tools, which are much bigger to carry, you know, and they're much heavier. So I bought that part. So now I can actually take the cassette off to fix a spoke if I do break a spoke on the rear wheel. Also, I need to learn how to do a spoke. So I can do everything else. I haven't done a spoke yet. So
yeah, I'm curious how one trues a wheel when you are on the road. That sounds like an interesting endeavor.
Yes, I've watched plenty of YouTube videos. I've got the tools for it. I'm confident I can get something right there. So I built the bike and I've done lots of other things with it. So I think I can do it.
Favorite part of your bike touring? Any particular locations that you really want to go back to?
Ooh, I really liked Southern Oregon. Was beautiful, the coast. I really also Santa Cruz was nice. Half Moon Bay was actually really nice. I think I spent about 2 weeks total out there.
I love Half Moon Bay.
Oh, it was nice.
It's so lovely.
Oh yeah, I actually there was a couple that let me stay in their home that they bought out there after they retired, and I stayed there for a couple days with their dogs. They gave me their whole upstairs to their house. It was overlooking the beach. It was so nice watching the sunset there. The campground, you can only stay one day there. Usually it's 3 to 5 days, other campgrounds. So what I would do is I would sneak in late at night, and I mean, I paid for it, but as long as, you know, they didn't see you there every single night, and I'd leave early in the morning, but I really did like Half Moon Bay. So I kept going back there. So, but I anywhere with the beach, it was beautiful. I really enjoyed watching the sunsets at night. Just listening to the ocean, it just felt nice. And you never know exactly how the sunset was going to be either. And I love that.
And as we close things out here on the road, my last question for you, unless anyone else has any questions for you, is have you ever been on a motorized two-wheel vehicle?
I have. When I was little, I want to say first grade, my dad bought me a little Harley. So I think that was one of the last times I was actually on a motorcycle.
Wait, hold on.
What?
They make child size motorcycles?
They used to,
yes. They do, yes.
What?
Why on earth would that ever...
Yes, it was one. It was about the same. Yeah, I also had a little, I think it was a Yamaha dirt bike, the same size as the Harley.
My other question is, are there pictures and can we see them?
There, I know I had pictures. They were in a storage unit and I don't know what happened to those, but I don't have any right now with me. I might be able to find those.
Oh my God.
I think we need those.
I'm Googling this right now. Child size Harley Davidson.
Yeah.
Well, if we can acquire some pictures either of you on these various devices or at least us doing some random searches, we'll include them in our show notes and link them on Instagram. But let's take a quick break and for the next drinks.
So let's bring this to the other kind of table, the drinking table. Jacob, what is this next drink that we are imbibing?
So this is a drink that I designed a couple years back and have tweaked a couple times based on as materials change. It's called the Alpine Kiss. And
that's cute.
It is a elderflower mineral water based cocktail that includes rosemary, a small touch of honey, and a good hit of lime to bring the flavors forward. It's a savory cocktail as opposed to a sweet cocktail. And it's designed to be something more than a summer cooler, but not super sugary, sweet, syrupy.
I just want to say, good move on going for savory over overly sweet, because I think that's the problem that non-alcoholic cocktails fall into way too often, is they just want to go and pump in and make it just like, I don't know, just gross and sugary and fruity, which there's so much more you can do with that.
Mm-hmm. So I want to address a little bit of a bugbear that's hanging out here, and that is something we talked about at the beginning, which is the fact that you very specifically use the word cocktail, while the rest of the pop culture would refer to this as a mocktail. Tell me your opinion on that term.
So this is an argument that I feel very strongly about and don't have a leg to stand on. I'm going to own that up front. Any English pedant can school me up, down, and sideways based on dictionary definition and even the etymology of the phrase cocktail, meaning adulterated alcohol. And so by the rule, they're right. However, I started getting into non-alcoholic cocktails for a variety of reasons. I had a bunch of friends who were straight edge skinheads. I have friends and family in recovery. I have people who would come to my events, but they needed a designated driver. And I always felt shitty. Here's your Diet Coke or your Fresca or whatever. And
don't you shit on Fresca.
And so, I mean, for a while, I had a standing once a month cocktail party at my house, and you did not get one of the non-alcoholic cocktails unless you were a designated driver. And I had people fight, couples fight over who the designated driver was. And the reason I dislike mocktails as a term is because it perpetuates this notion that you can fucking phone it in. And when I do a non-alcoholic cocktail, I put all the thought of layering, of how flavors go together, how mouthfeel goes. You're not getting a goddamn Shirley Temple. You're not getting a Roy Rogers. You're not getting a glass of how much fucking simple syrup I can shove into it. You're not getting something that's basically lemonade with another juice mixed in. You're getting something that was composed with thought and craft.
I could not agree more with just Jacob over here. To me, when I hear mocktail, it's kind of like mocking or a mockery of the craft of bartending itself. And so, like Jacob, when someone asks me to go and make a non-alcoholic cocktail for them, I actually like the term zero-proof cocktail myself. Hmm. Then I do the same thing. I ask them, what flavors do you like? Let me tell you what I have. I'm going to work with you here. And it's because of the trying circumstances at some of the bars that I work at Edgefield, it cannot always be the easiest thing to make them something really interesting. But when I am at some of the bars that have much more ingredients, it gives me a lot of ways to go and play and make them something that is delicious so they can go and not feel left out and also have something good, and they don't have to feel like they're just, you know, yeah, as Jacob said, sucking on simple syrup.
And you mentioned something there, the zero-proof cocktails. I liked that term for a while, but then I really started to think about it because I do two sorts of quote-unquote non-alcoholic cocktails. One I generally mentally classify as what I call cooking cocktails, which is there is as much alcohol in this drink as if I made you a bechamel linguine from scratch. So they're, you know, the white wine's been entirely cooked off.
Can you do that for me sometime?
Bechamel white wine?
Linguine, yes.
Yeah, yes, we can definitely make that happen. Campolo?
Not drooling.
Okay. But anyways, so in the for those, I'm allowed a couple exceptions. I'm allowed to use vanilla, a really good vanilla, which requires alcohol to be used as a component of extracting the bean, and I get to use bitters. That is less of a factor now because we actually have quality zero alcohol bitters on the market, but not being able to use a couple dashes, like there's a variation on the Alpine Kiss, which is called the Alpine Fire, that one of the big additions to it is three drops of Anacostra syrup. Mm. the amount of alcohol in there is measured in fractions of a microgram. Mm-hmm. But it's, I would never hand that across the counter as a zero proof cocktail. And so there's what I call cooking cocktails, and then there's zero proof cocktails. And so I'd make that distinction a little bit.
Mm-hmm. That actually is a good distinction to make. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm pretty sure that Fee Brothers bitters use no alcohol. Is that correct?
Some of their lines do. Some of their lines don't, but they very clearly state on the bottle.
So if you're looking for bitters out there that are an exceptional addition to non-alcoholic cocktails, again, they're very easily designated as, here's alcohol content, and if it says nothing, then it has none, because by law it has to state if it has it or not. And there are, I mean, there's so many good ones out there too. And so that just adds such a nice touch to nose and taste of any kind of non-alcoholic cocktail you want to go and experiment and make.
My dislike of the term mocktail comes also from the root of mock, but not as mockery to the bartender, but mockery to the drinker. So this idea that if you are out somewhere and you're not drinking alcohol, that you should be mocked in some way, or you should, it should be drawn attention to, and you should have, there should be fingers pointed at you as like, oh, you're a square or whatever. And I think that's just kind of rude, because there's lots of reasons why somebody might not imbibe alcohol.
Well, and it should be respected, someone's decision to do this.
It should be respected, yeah. That should be respected if somebody's not going to imbibe alcohol. I just want to, real quick, Jacob, when you talked about your straight-edge skinheads, you mean sharps, right?
I was going to ask for a clarification as well.
Yes.
Okay, just I mean, figured. I'm just checking.
This takes us down a rabbit hole, but... there's more than just sharps that in the
in that vein of the
not gotcha. The bad kind of skinheads is what you're trying
not
to
the
say.
Bad kind of skinheads. Okay, gotcha. Just wanted to point a fact on that. At any rate, so dear listener, you might be asking yourself right now, well, you are Bikers Dice and Bars. I think it's very interesting that you're talking about non-alcoholic cocktails. Why are you doing that this evening?
Well, for starters, is that there is a big movement here in Portland among some of our craft bartenders and bar owners who want to be sensitive and accepting of the fact that not everyone wants to drink. And so they're starting to be pushing out a lot of very, very good non-alcoholic bartending menus in the city. In fact, almost every bar worth its salt now, kind of the higher end of bars, they do have an actual separate menu that has, NA cocktails on them, which is actually really kind of nice and thoughtful. Not all of them are good, but there are places like Departure, which have really nice non-alcoholic cocktail menus, and it's a really fancy, swanky place, so that's kind of cool. There are also, later this year, actually, there's going to be a brand new, exclusively non-alcoholic bar opening up called Sucker Punch.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, the owner of this place, Andy McMillan, I believe his name is, decided not that long ago to stop drinking. And he still likes going out and thought, okay, I wish there was kind of a place for me where there's not only good non-alcoholic drinks to have, but also no temptation at all to be like, okay, I just want to, like, oh, I can smell it. I can see it. It's on this person's breath. And this place is going to be entirely non-alcoholic. There's going to be kombucha on tap. There's going to be a lot of things using shrubs. And I just was looking on his Instagram right now, and God damn, these cocktails don't look sexy. Like, I'm interested in trying them, and that's weird coming from me.
It's kind of interesting because we're at an interesting confluence yet here. And just in preparation for this episode, I was talking through a couple of my thoughts with some acquaintances of mine who are in the industry. And one of the things we hit on is we have this great confluence. It is finally so much more publicly acceptable to be in recovery. We spent the 80s and a big chunk of the 90s with that being a shame thing. And that was not okay. And beyond that, we have people who are making a decision to do that by choice as a lifestyle for whatever reason. People who are doing it for their health. And a greater acceptance that certain ethnic groups don't have a drinking culture. And so there's that. And what we were talking about, in addition to the rise of non-alcoholic cocktails to meet all these needs, was we're also seeing a change. This is going hand in hand with a bit of a change in bar culture. Now, this is Biker's Dice and Bars. We love a good dive bar. We like the places where you can come in, the floor is vaguely sticky, and the guy on the counter has been there for the last 6 hours. But that said, we're seeing what's kind of been, we kind of came to the consensus that the proper term was a return to the public house model of drinking, where the point was it was a house of community and a house of gathering that, just like any good other hosted event or place, would have alcohol. We're returning to, rather than bars and taverns, we're returning to more of a public house model. And so it's a place to socialize. It's basically alcohol coming into the place where coffee houses have operated for quite some time. And it's the similar idea of you come in, and yes, beverages and food and stuff are available, and maybe you're there just to hook your fix. Like, I mean, me and a coffee shop are never too far apart. But going there to engage with a community and engage with friends and have that the reason for being there. And that is part of this whole slurry of a bunch of different trends going on. And I really think it's a positive one.
Well, and that brings us to why are we specifically doing non-alcoholic cocktails this evening? Our special guest, Joe, you've been in recovery for about a little over 8 years now.
I've been sober for over 8 years. I actually got into recovery a little over 10 years. There was a relapse there. So that's why it's now over 8 years. Mm-hmm.
And what would you be willing to share with us about being in recovery in Portland, Oregon, which has a huge drinking culture, and in being in recovery in general?
Well, yes, there is a big drinking culture here. You know, and I think that there is a big issue with some people who, you know, go out and party all the time and hang out in bars, you know, because there's a big nightlife here in Portland. And I think some people have an issue kind of leaving that or thinking that there's something different than that or something more enjoyable than that lifestyle. I know for me, when I got sober, I would go out to bars occasionally. So I knew about the whole nightlife in Portland. But I didn't really participate in a whole lot of that. So if I went out, I would go out to a bar, you know, drink quite a bit, end up back home. That was kind of it. So, I mean, it was usually something close to where I was living. So when I got sober, I didn't really have that, oh, I'm, you know, missing out on all this, you know, bar culture, or, you know, just the culture here in Portland. Because the bars I went to were not really, you know, they were kind of like Yam Hill Pub, Matador, which I don't think is there.
That was the first thing I was going to say was the Yam Hill.
Yeah, when I was homeless, I went to the Yam Hill Pub. They would let me hang out, bust the tables, give me free pitchers. That was, you know, that was kind of it. So I knew about that bar whenever I got off the street here. And then I started going to the Matador, which was a step up from the Yam Hill Pub.
A baby step, but yes.
Yes. I'll agree.
I believe we've talked about both of those bars before on this podcast.
There, and then the Green Tortoise, they've got that $1.99 breakfast, they did then. That was like
I think they
ago.
Still do, because I went there just a few years ago, and they still had it, and it's a perfectly great breakfast.
Oh, yeah. $1.99, you get 2 eggs and a piece of toast from what I can remember. All right. Something
is it Green
like
Tortoise?
That.
Happy Tortoise? Is
Green Tortoise. They have two. There's Green Tortoise and there's
Cheerful Tortoise.
Or cheerful Tortoise.
Why am I thinking green?
That's the Cheerful Bullpen.
Cheerful
and the
Bullpen
cheerful
is the
pit
one.
Stop.
Yes. Okay.
Okay.
Cheerful Bullpen was, yeah, close to me because I was Matador. Back and forth to those. But you know, going out to those bars, they weren't, you know, nothing too fancy. But, you know, so I do see an issue with some people trying to get sober and wanting to, you know, continue doing that. But, you know, what I've realized, it took me a while to realize this after I got sober is, you know, whenever I was drinking then, I thought, okay, this is what everyone does. But really, all it was me being around everyone else doing what I was doing. So that's why I thought the only fun was to go out there and drink all night, you know? Mm-hmm. So a while after I got sober, you know, I started making friends that were also sober. And, you know, we go out and do things. I've been out, going out to, you know, places to go bowl, going out to dinner, going out to parks, just meeting up with people and doing different things like that. Which is actually a lot of fun, you know, and I didn't think I would enjoy doing other things other than drinking. So
I think a big part of people's hesitation to kind of like what we're alluding to in going sober, if they know that they have a problem, is you know, the fear of missing out or the fear of also going and losing their social scene. And I think if you really look at it, sometimes if your scene is just there because they're drinking, kind of like you're saying, like that's not much of a good scene to be a part of. And if you're a friend who's not going to accept somebody who wants to go sober, you're not a very good friend.
Yes.
And I think that we can all agree that, you know, we should encourage people that we know that maybe do need to go into recovery, that maybe do have a problem, that I'm here for you. I'll support you. And whatever you decide to do, like, that's fine. And, you know, and also, too, if you are that friend who wants to support the friend who's trying to go sober, take them out someplace else that's not going to be a bar. Take them someplace that's not going to be a place where alcohol is around. There's plenty of places like that. And soon to be Sucker Punch.
Well, and to support that without judgment.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And a big part of supporting somebody without judgment is allowing them to have their own process. Some people go abstinence only route and some people go harm reduction route and everything in between in that spectrum. So helping somebody along their process so they discover what's going to work for them.
And you pointed out a big thing. One of the biggest challenges for a lot of folks in recovery is because so much of their life was circling drinking. Taking that out and trying to avoid activities that involve drinking becomes really, really difficult. And so being that friend who can do suggest, hey, do you want to go bowling tonight on a bar, one of the bowling alleys that's not a huge bar, or something else. I used to be an Argentinian tangoist. I loved going. I sucked at it. I am as graceful as an ox, but it was a fun thing. A huge chunk of the people who'd show up for that were folks who were either in recovery or didn't like to drink because drinking was not the focus of the event, but it had a lot of the same feel of a fun nightlife party culture. You could get it without, you know, having to deal with all of the other issues.
If I may suggest, too, take your friends to Glowing Greens. Glowing Greens is amazing.
Oh, yeah.
Glowing Greens is a subterranean, blacklight, pirate-themed miniature golf course in the heart of downtown Portland. And that place is fun.
I think they also now have axe throwing and an escape room there, too.
Escape rooms are a great
Yeah. So these are a bunch of things, too, that, again, are super duper fun. Ooh, take them to Enchanted Forest.
Oh, dear.
Oh, yeah.
And that's terrifying.
One of our favorite local movie theaters, the Roseway Theater.
Roseway.
Roseway does not serve alcohol. It was one of the very few theaters that I know of here in town that does not yet serve alcohol. They have your standard popcorn and soda and candy.
They always have one movie and it's a new one.
And it's a huge theater, too.
Huge.
The movie's only like $8, like all the time. It's all pretty time. Great.
I also 100% snuck a freshly baked blackberry pie in there once. and the guy just looked at me and goes, what do you got in there, a pie? And I just went, yes. I think he was joking. And I just was like, I feel so called out right now.
I might have snuck a sandwich in there once.
Yeah.
I know that I hosted a birthday for a friend at Cinemagic, which is a similar operation over on Hawthorne. Hawthorne and 21st.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So bringing this back into reincorporate the topic, Joe, if you don't mind, what pushed you into recovery? When did you make that decision?
Well, that actually took, you know, I had to hit some bottoms there. So ultimately what it came down to was hitting some bottoms and becoming willing to make changes in my life. You know, for years I had thought maybe I'll make some changes. You know, I wanted to do something different off and on. It's, you know, my lifestyle. I just get sick of it because it was often, you know, living on the street or, you know, just things like that, which was a lot of fun for some time. But there were those times where I'm like, maybe I want something different. So there were times I wanted something different. There was times I, you know, needed to do something different because, you know, I'd end up in the hospital or jail or just something like that. But it wasn't until I became willing to. And I think that's a big thing there. You know, whenever I had first, let's see, I actually went to a recovery meeting in, 2009. And what made me do that is I was just, you know, I'd wake up early in the morning. I would go to work. I would start getting sick around noon because I get really bad alcohol withdrawals. I get off work and I would start drinking. And if I sat down, I would pass out. And if I passed out, I'd have to wake up and start drinking again. I was so sleep deprived that I was drinking 30 to 40 plus beers a day and it wasn't getting me drunk. And then I'd wake up throughout the night and I'd have to drink myself back to sleep. If it was before 4 a.m., I could start drinking. If it was after 4 a.m., I couldn't start because if I started, then I couldn't stop and I'd have to go into work. And I couldn't go into work if I was drinking. At least I didn't want to. So I didn't do that. When I was younger, actually only a couple of years prior to that, I would sometimes drink up to a half gallon of vodka and go into work. I would black out. I would not remember even getting to work. And that was, at the time I was able to do that. I don't know how I did that now, but it was just, but that was really miserable for me. Prior to that, I used to get withdrawals and I used to love drinking the beer and just watching myself slowly stop shaking. It felt good. There was all this relief I would get. I would feel comfortable around people. It made everything better for me then. But it wasn't until I wasn't getting any relief from alcohol at all. It was just miserable. It was drinking. I didn't get drunk. I just drank to try to feel better. And I wasn't feeling better. It was just spending money. I would wake up in the morning and just sitting up, using my stomach muscles to sit up. It made me feel sick for, hours after that. Just, I was so unhealthy. I was in the hospital right before that. They told me I probably wouldn't live much longer because I was getting severe heartburn and all these other health issues. And, my first thing I did after I got out of the hospital is I went and started drinking again. So, that was just kind of how addiction is. It doesn't matter what the issue is. Everything makes you want to do it more. So it doesn't matter. But, whenever I got to that point, I had told my brother and my friend who we were all living together at the time, I said, hey, I need to go to a meeting or something because I cannot stop. There's nothing, and I knew there were meetings around. I was introduced to a recovery program when I was 13. So I knew stuff existed. I didn't know what to do. I didn't know what was going to happen, but I knew there was something there. So they took me to this place and, I've been active in a recovery program since then. Now I don't go to this program to stay sober. I know how to stay sober. I go there just to kind of, I feel centered by going there. I feel a little bit more sane. I get to listen to other people talk about, what they do day to day, what helps them, their issues, and I can relate to that. There's something about being there that just helps me, and I can go there and help other people as well. So, and that's a big thing is me being able to reach out and help other people that are in need of help because I've been there and I know, how that is. And unless you've actually been in that situation, it's hard to know exactly, how someone is. So, being in that position to help people, that's something that really helps me out in my recovery today.
When you were first starting to go into recovery or decided you needed to make this transition in your life, were there people around there to help you? Were people supportive of you or was it kind of looked down upon?
No, people were very supportive, actually. I feel that, pretty much anyone I drank with or anyone I told that were probably happy that I was actually going to go that route. When I was younger, I lived on the street off and on, starting from around the age of 15. And, I would just, from the time I was 13 up until my mid-20s, I blacked out almost every day from drinking. That was just my life. I would wake up. It was an exciting thing to wake up and just start drinking until I would black out. I drank a lot. I did a lot of drugs on top of that. And, I did a lot of risky things that could have killed me. I've drug overdoses, falling off freight trains. I've waken up in the hospital, waking up in jail. I've waken up after getting my peg kicked into a curb with steel toes. And that was actually, I woke up to my mom sitting there crying. And that was when I was in my early 20s, things like that. So I think when people knew that I wanted to get sober and I was telling people, they were very supportive and happy and probably surprised too. Is what I get from that. Because I've had people tell me that, they didn't expect me to actually get sober the way I was living. I lived a pretty extreme lifestyle for a while there. And especially going through, my teens and up into my early 20s, just living that way. So I did actually have a bit of support. There were people that I hung out with whenever I partied that no longer want to hang out with me, not because I was sober, but because they didn't want to, do something in front of me and kind of assist in me going out, or at least that was their thought, which, I'm glad that even people that had issues with addiction were trying to help me. So there's lots of support. And I think most people with addictions, they're going to be supportive of other people trying to get sober because they know what it's like. Even if they're not in a place where they're willing to make that change, they know that, it's, that's good for that person. So.
And there's many different ways to get into recovery, to get sober or to get back to a healthier lifestyle, less risky lifestyle. And sort of my little public service announcement is that detoxing from alcohol can be quite dangerous. it can be deadly. People do detox and have seizures and die. And detoxing from alcohol and benzodiazepines is actually one of the more dangerous things you can quit cold turkey.
Yeah.
And so my question for you, if you are comfortable asking this, is did you do any kind of medication assisted detox, or were you able to taper? How did that work for you?
So I actually knew there was detox programs around. So I got a phone book and found Hooper Detox here in Portland. I had called them. They told me I had to come in there. I forget exactly what they said, but I think I was supposed to come in there. So in my head, I'm like, well, I can't do that. I have to work. So I bought some benzos from someone I knew and took those. And the withdrawals I had were still so severe. I sweated through my mattress. And for a few days there, I would lay in my bed. I could see birds flying around in my bedroom. I had a snake at the time, and I kept seeing her wrapping around me. And I would feel bugs and spiders crawling on me. And even getting up and turning the light on, I could still see and feel them, which is kind of intense when you know you're not on a drug to make you hallucinate like that, but you're seeing and feeling things like that. So it gets really bad. And I used to shake so bad that I would almost start to feel like I was going into a seizure. Like I could not pick up something and drink it. I would shake that bad. And there were times, you know, one that was really bad. I actually woke up in a train yard on the ground. And for about 3 days, I couldn't get up because I was so weak from drinking. And every time I closed my eyes, I thought dogs were attacking me. It was an intense thing, but I've had similar things like that happen. And that's just whenever you're drinking that much each day, you do get to that point. And that is dangerous. And I think a lot of people are unaware that that is something that can actually kill you. And I knew that at the time, but at the same time, I thought I could do things on my own. So that's why I did not actually go to the hospital. I mean, I knew benzos would help, and that's why I purchased those. But they still, I mean, they helped. I think if I wouldn't have taken those, it would have been much worse than it actually was. Mm-hmm. So, but yeah, I did get some medication, but I did it on my own still.
Okay.
Yeah.
DTs, delirium tremens, are a scary thing.
Yeah. They are, yes.
Yeah. They're
intense. And I've actually had... You know, there was a time I had OD'd on fentanyl and almost died from that. And those withdrawals were extremely severe. I had actually had to go to the hospital for that. But the alcohol withdrawals I've had are actually much worse than that. It depends. You know, some people get really bad withdrawals before they quit. Some people don't get withdrawals that bad. So, you know, it kind of varies from person to person, how much you drink and all that. So
if someone wants to seek out help, and if someone thinks that they have a problem, what is their best course of action to do, in your opinion or in your experience?
You know, I think with that, especially alcohol, anything big, you can be addicted to anything. It could, you know, anything can really mess with you there. But I think best, going through what I did would be something like, you know, checking with Hooper Detox. That would be one of the best places, I think, or something. So a place where you can detox at, even checking with the hospital, they can actually, you know, hook you up with where to go from there. With alcohol, definitely, that's something that people should do. You know, heroin, coming down off that, you do need to detox from those things. If you go to a detox place, they're going to provide you with information on other places to go. You know, it's not like a one shoe fits all type thing. There's many different routes people can go in recovery. There's 12-step programs. There's smart recovery. I know there's a lot of other things out there. There's things I haven't tried, but I know stuff I do currently with my recovery program works for me. But I've seen people, you know, get sober many other ways. And the things they do, I know would not work for me, but they work for them. So everyone's different. And I think that's something that's good for people to keep in mind, is there's not one route that is perfect for anyone. So there's many different options out there. But definitely a hospital or a detox place would definitely have the information on other resources. And just keeping an open mind and going to one place, you're going to find resources for other places as well. So
in addition to that, for our listeners outside the Portland area, just about every part of the United States is part of what's called the 211 service line. If you need non-emergency services, i.e. you don't need a cop, you don't need a paramedic, you don't need a firefighter, but you need help finding help, pick up a phone, dial *211 or 211, depending on if you're using your phone system. Just like 911, you'll get connected to an operator. They'll talk to you through what you're going through. Are you needing utility assistance, housing assistance? Are you needing rehab? In addition to all of our vets out there, just know that any and all veterans crisis lines, doesn't matter whether they're suicide or others, have resources on tap for your specific experience needs.
And I kind of want to go and bring this back to the bar for a second, too. You know, it's frustrating to me sometimes when you go into a bar and you're with your friend who is not drinking, and the three of you order a drink, and the other person orders, like, oh, just a soda, just a soda water, and the bartender, or the waitress gives them some, like, attitude about it. Don't be that person. Don't ever be that person. That makes you...
Which person?
Oh, yeah. Oh, sorry. That, I guess that's a good point of clarification.
Which guy? Don't be what guy?
Don't be that guy.
Don't be that guy.
Don't be that waitress or bartender that just kind of looks down on the person who's not ordering a drink. You don't know what they're going through. You don't know what they're trying to fix. You don't know a lot of things. Just don't judge people, man. Like, don't do it. I know that, you know, as bartenders work off of tips and, you know, I mean, here's the thing, too. Also, bars out there that charge people for soda water, you're an asshole.
You're an asshole.
Don't do that.
Yeah, fuck you.
Like, okay, a soda, fine, whatever. There's some syrup in there. You're charging for a little bit of carbonation? Like, fuck off.
And a wedge of lime that's 2 days old?
I mean, technically, technically, we're not supposed to do that, but.
Sure.
Yeah, the places we go to. Sure.
Sure. Those are all fresh.
Yeah, but I mean, yeah, just give someone a soda water. That's fine. Like, you know, make it look cool for them. I don't know. Like, just don't look down on these people. It's so infuriating to me when we see that. And, you know, I know Jacob and I don't do that because we're not that guy.
No, we're not that guy. However, if you're on the flip side of the thing, you're coming in, you're ordering a Coke, a soda water, doesn't matter whether you charge or not, it is appropriate to tip.
Still tip.
Toss a buck, toss 50 cents, contribute something because you're still getting the service. I can totally understand the drive to stiff someone who treats you like shit for requesting that. And I'm not going to judge if you do it. But if you get a modicum of service out of the deal, do the right thing and tip.
And also, too, if you order the soda water and, you know, the bartender rolls their eyes at you, too, just throwing that dollar down, that might actually change their opinion next time someone just orders a soda water. So, I mean, you know, be the change you want to see, even if it's just with a little bit of change.
A little bit of change. Ooh, I like that.
This is the last call for alcohol this evening. Drink up, drink up, drink up, and order again. This is the last call for alcohol, get going. Drink up, drink up, drink up, then order again.
All right, Jacob, what is our third and final drink here you've made for us?
I'll tell you after you take a sip.
I'm really excited. It smells
fantastic. It tastes like liquid curry, like I'm drinking a curry.
Liquid courage?
Sure. Yeah.
Delicious.
Yeah. Oh my God. This is my delicious. Favorite
Holy
one.
Holy crap.
My favorite one so far.
Cool.
So this is called A Gentleman in Bengal.
Ooh.
It is.
Fancy.
It's the building block is cock and bull syrup.
That's ginger beer.
Yeah. Cock and bull ginger beer. Sorry. My apologies. I was grabbing the next thing row.
He was grabbing the syrup.
In this case, we're using Rose's sweetened lime juice. Generally, I actually prefer to make my own simple syrup and mix in a teaspoon of lime juice to the simple syrup as I'm mixing it in. A squirt of lemon is added as well. And a sprinkle of curry powder is in there during the shake.
So good.
Now, just to put this in perspective, this is not quite the true recipe because normally I serve it in a Collins glass. And after it's in your glass, I add depending on the strength of the curry powder, either a good tonic such as Fever Tree, which is milder and not corn syrupy, or most often a little seltzer just to lighten it up a touch.
I think that effervescence would really just put this thing over the moon.
Yeah. The problem is that I only had one bottle of seltzer with me, and it's my elderflower seltzer.
This is great. I would gladly just sip slowly on this in my study while imagining myself smoke a cigar, because I don't. And doing some research on an ancient tome in Lost Egypt.
So there's a story behind this one that is very apropos of what we've been talking about and all the different reasons people drink. This drink was made by me and a work colleague of mine back when I used to work in kitchens. He was a Somali refugee and was a practicing Muslim. He could not drink. And let's just say, like many kitchens, functional alcoholism is the way business is done.
Also lots of cocaine.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I can neither
whatever.
Confirm nor deny that. Okay. but we'd hit the after shift. Everybody's crowded around the bar. And at this particular establishment, I worked both occasional line and bar. And so I was serving everybody their after shift drinks. And he was like, can I have, I can't even remember what it was, because he also liked to avoid caffeine for whatever reason. He got way wired on it. And so we had had a Indian special on the menu that night, and he and I talked through it. And that gave birth to the Gentleman in Bengal, which is this tip to Indian flavors come British colonial influences in a non-alcoholic setting. And he just loved it so much. And so that's how it came about. And it was completely designed for someone who chose not to drink due to religious reasons.
Can you make me like a picture of this, please?
Yeah. Can this just like... summertime and we just hang out on the porch when it's really hot. Can we just have this
fun fact? It's better when I make it by the pitcher.
I don't believe you. You're going to have to show us.
Honestly, if you were like, if I for some reason woke up one day and was like, you know what, Poppy, you need to quit drinking alcohol for whatever reason. I would be totally happy drinking this for the rest of my life. This is amazing.
Yes, this is delicious. Yeah.
Thanks for mixing us all of these beverages tonight, Jacob. Yeah. This has been quite an episode. Joe, thanks for telling us all about your life.
Well, thank you for having me.
And your story. Would you like to tell us a little bit about your leather goods for any potential customers who might be listening to our show?
So currently, or what I've been doing a lot this last year is mostly wallets. I do have ideas for some bags I want to start getting into. There's a lot of different things I want to make. There's just never enough time in the day.
Ain't that the truth?
Yeah. This last year, I started this business in 2016. And the last year or so, I've just been extremely busy. So I haven't had a whole lot of time to create new things. So a lot of it's been wallets and stuff like that. Just small leather goods. I also make fetish gear. So that was, you know, when I first started the business, that's what I was making. The fetish gear was fun to make, but I also, you know, mass produce it. I make it on a sewing machine, which is still fun, but it's not as fun as sitting down and hand sewing something. So that's why I've been really into wallets and, you know, their small leather goods, is because I can sit and hand sew them. I also started, trying out different kinds of leather from different tanneries. My favorite tanneries are actually in Italy. They have some beautiful leather. A lot of my wallets, or most of them, are made with Italian leather right now. I also am just kind of getting into exotics. So I'm getting ready to enter a maker's competition, and I'm making some exotic fetish gear, which is exciting because I've looked around online and I've seen some people who have made some stuff, and it looks good. But what I'm doing right now is I'm using the techniques I've learned for these small leather goods, and I'm actually applying those to this fetish gear. So I'm really excited to see how these things turn out. I've got a photo shoot scheduled for next week, so that's going to be very exciting with the new gear. So I need to actually have that made over the next few days. So I'm working on it. I'm going to get it done. But, you know, doing things like this have kind of prevented me from moving forward and creating new things. But I do have a lot of things that I do want to make. I've, you know, have a lot of people who've asked me to make them different things, especially purses, little backpack purses, stuff like that, which I want to do. So over this next year, that is one of my goals, is to get into making some bigger things rather than just my small leather goods that I've been doing. So
what's this makers competition all about? Can people come and watch, or is it Tell us more.
So it's actually a company that is putting this on. So basically you buy something from them, some kind of exotic leather. And when you're making, you get to pick what you want to make. While you're making, you can post different photos of the process or, you know, the finished product. And you're going to submit them to this company. So what they're going to do is next month kind of post them on their Instagram and on their Facebook. And the way it's judged is by the amount of likes that you get on there. So if I get the most likes on there, then I will win. So
that doesn't sound like an actual competition. That sounds like a popularity competition. And I'm still bitter about that time in eighth grade when I clearly had the best Halloween costume, but a bunch of stupid popular girls dressed up like twins, looked like each other, somehow won because they knew everybody. Whereas I, unpopular kid, came in a very strong second because my costume actually was fucking cool. Yeah, I was Gilligan. Everyone else can suck it.
Whatever, Seth. I mean, just let it go, Seth.
Well, we'll try to.
I'll let go of nothing.
We will try to share the link on all of our multiple social media sites when that is released, and we'll try to get you some likes. Cause
that would be great.
Because your leather goods, I must say, are quite good.
Thank you.
And I would note that by the time this episode comes out, you should probably be a day or two away from starting that. I think because this is going to release early next week.
Oh, nice! Yeah.
Perfect.
What are these beautiful things of leather I'm looking in front of me right now? What are these things? Where do these come from?
To make the story short and family friendly, I met Joe at an event a few years ago selling his wares. And we started chatting and we became friends. And here we are now. And I have bought many, many leather things from him over the years. Well, I guess how many? This is not everything because you've done some custom orders for me that I've done as gifts. Yes. So they're not sitting here on this table. But I have the first thing I ever bought from him, which is this beautiful leather wallet.
Keep in mind, this is an audio medium.
I know. Okay. I know. I'm showing it to the people.
She's spreading them open right now.
We're going to have.
Showing us all the little pockets on it.
We're going to have pictures online. I have. So we have two wallets here. One of your minimalist wallets. Beautiful pair of red leather earrings that I get lots of compliments on. My little key ring here, and my beautiful passport cover that you made for me.
Oh, I love those colors.
Yeah, this turned out really, really lovely.
I want to let the audience know that this keychain has a really adorable owl on it, and it looks lovely.
Oh, and I also have this bracelet here too.
Oh yeah, the little double wrap bracelet.
The little double wrap bracelet, yeah. And I had you custom make the trifold wallet for my father for Christmas one year. That was fun.
That was actually fun. I have had orders for that since then, and I've changed around the pattern that I created a little bit. I'm planning on making some more for an event that I'm going to be at next month, so hopefully I can get those done. But that was actually fun. I had never made a trifold before, so yeah.
So Joe, we know you're Joe.
Yes.
However, I think if someone were to go and Google Joe Leather, they might not be able to find you.
No, I don't think so.
How are they going to find you if they want to purchase one of these fine goods?
The best way is through Instagram. I make most of my connections actually through there. Surprisingly, I didn't think that social media would bring me in this much business, but I actually do a lot of business through there. Instagram is the number one way, I would say.
Shut up and take my money. What is the handle? What is the handle?
It is ramblin_leather_goods.
Is there a G at the end of that ramblin?
No, there is not.
That's kind of what I got from the way that you pronounced it, but I wanted to make sure that our listeners at home knew to not include that G.
Oh, yes. Yeah, that I actually had a different name up until I did the whole bike tour business thing. That's when I had changed my name to Ramblin. I felt there was some more meaning behind it because I got into this when I was kind of rambling around on freight trains and traveling around. That's what started, you know, my interest in leather, you know, losing my wallet and starting to make one. And then when I had actually decided to make this business full time, that was actually when I went on that, you know, 5-month bike trip. And I took the time to design things and actually try marketing stuff. So I felt that was a pretty good name. And I think it fits pretty well.
Oh my God, your bad motherfucker wallet is amazing.
Oh, I sold so many of those over the holiday season.
Well, let's go ahead and close this out. Thanks again for joining us, Joe.
Thank you.
And thanks again, listener, for sticking with us for one more episode. I hope you check out some of Joe's things online and in regards to our heavy talk in the previous segment.
Yeah, to follow up on our conversations about addiction and recovery, if you think you might You know, if you wake up one day and think, I might have a problem, that's worth looking at. And there are many different options to getting into recovery or to feeling better, getting well, or however you want to view it. And, you know, you got to find what works for you, and you've got to find a way to reach recovery that is going to feel good and sustainable for you. And please don't hesitate to ask for help. The worst thing you could do is stay silent and stay isolated and keep that secret. And reach out to somebody you trust, call 211, reach out to your local mental health or substance abuse treatment team, and, you know, start the process.
For shit, reach out to us.
Yeah, if you need help, you will happily send you along some links between the four of us. We know a lot.
And yes, I've got some resources as well.
Yeah, between the five of us, yeah. And no matter where you're at, we can try to help track down some help for you, and you will have our support 100%.
Bikers Dice and Bars loves you and cares about you and wants you to be well.
Cheers.
Again, thanks for listening. I was NPC.
I'm Just Jacob.
Dr. Xander Gerrymander.
I am Poppy Beaujolais.
Joe.
And we wish to remind you, as usual,
keep it shiny side up.
Always tip your bartender.
Always roll those crits.
Please always drink responsibly.
Or not at all. That can be a thing.
One day at a time.
Thanks for joining us, friend. We've reached the end of Bikers, Dice, and Bars. Talking bicycles and motorbikes, gamer things and all the like. You can listen to it in your car. The Bikers, Dice, and Bars.